Welcome to Poetry Spotlight, presented by the Ohio Poetry Association. I am your host, Jeremy Jusek, and with us today is Sandra Rivers Gill. Sandra is an award-winning poet, playwright, and performer. Her poetry has been featured in numerous journals and anthologies, and she's a Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net nominee. She's the editor of Dopeless Hope Fiends, a poetry anthology penned by women in recovery, a project underwritten by a grant through the Toledo Arts Commission Accelerated Program. She's served as a teaching artist for Naomi Incorporated, a nonprofit treatment facility, Friendship Baptist Church Drama Ministry, and Otterbein Sunset House Senior Life Communities. And most recently, she has been a judge for the Ohio and Pennsylvania Poetry Competitions as a featured author at the 2024 Ohioana Book Festival, and is one of the 25 teaching artists selected to take part in the Creative Aging Ohio Initiative, administered by the Ohio Arts Council. Sandra's debut chapbook, As We Cover Ourselves with Light, is published by Shilanah Gig Editions as of late last year. Please visit her website, which will be updated very soon. Sandra, thank you so very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me. Thanks for inviting me to this wonderful forum. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Could you please start with a poem?
I will. Let's see. I'm going to start with something in my book. And all right. It's called Formal Education. My son informs me he was schooled today, almost chalked up like a blackboard lesson. I am reminded my son is a tree bearing the danger of low fruit suspended. History is a class of teachers marking him absent, but he sees the chariots of fire. My son tells me he does not resist the distant sound of blue night calling him. His answers attempt to soothe the silence and the trick of whirling lights. He is a man, no longer a boy, bound to dim narratives. His truth is a false arrest. The dog tags of discharge hang about his neck. My son tells me his life is a virtual classroom, full of routine exams, while onlookers passively grade on curves and theories and metaphors that detain a body.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Chalk it up to wordplay. So you use a lot of wordplay. Is that like something that is after the fact where you kind of edit it in because it makes sense? Or is it something that you're like, you see it coming from a mile away? Is wordplay that natural to you? Because you seem like a punny person.
I can be. Well, you know, at this poem, this is a variation of a poem that didn't get published. This one got published after I changed the title. And so I noticed too that in my poems, there are some dualities in words. I use a lot of homonyms in some of the work. If you notice in this poem, I use the word dim, you know, and that could be, it can mean several things to different people. Dim as a light bulb, or dim something not so far in the past, dim. And I like to use those things. Sometimes it comes naturally and I'll have to read it back again. It's like, oh, wow, I use that. It's like, I like that. I'm going to keep that. And then sometimes after I read the poem and there's something not quite jiving for me, I'll pick out certain words in there and maybe change them. That keeps that that main theme threading throughout the rest of the poem. And so I think it's kind of natural. I believe I don't intentionally do it, but I think it's something that comes natural. And then just these words just pop up in my head to use them metaphorically like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you have, so you're a performance artist and you write poetry and you're a playwright. Between those three, what is your relationship with words versus creativity in general? Like, how do you see yourself? Or like, maybe not even yourself, but like, how do you see words as a tool for like getting yourself out to other people? And I guess, how does that differentiate like between performance, because I love asking this question, like where does the line between performance and reaching readers through the page, like
Okay.
where is that for you?
I like to think I am a poet on paper, but I can also write for the stage. Okay. And for me, they're almost one of the same. To write a poem on page, it takes a different format, if you will, where you're reading it and somebody's listening to it from their chairs, and you're standing up there behind a podium, possibly, and you're reading from a book, and it's fine. But when you perform a poem, there's something that comes alive. Not that it doesn't in the book for you when you're reading it, it comes alive because you are essentially standing on a stage. Not that you didn't have confidence reading a book, but something about memorizing and being confident in what you're saying and telling the story that makes the reader or the listener sit up in their seat or drop their jaw and thought, oh my gosh, is that real? Was she saying? Or it, you just kind of touch the, I guess, the spirit of the people, and somehow there's this conversation between the two of you that wouldn't ordinarily happen if you're just reading from a book. And maybe that's different for other people. I don't know. I feel energized when I'm up on stage and I am confident about what I'm doing, and I can look at the audience and keep talking, and in the background I'm saying, make sure you don't read off the page in your mind, and all these different things. And it's an interesting thing. I would say not recently, and I don't always headline myself as a spoken word poet. It's something I do, and I do it on special occasions, but maybe when I first encountered that, it was an invitation from a friend to be involved in the spoken word troupe. And so there were three of us. We were called the 419. It was part of the Mad Poet Society here in Toledo. And they have a youth component now, and it's more educational, and the students go out and things like that. But I was challenged to write poems, memorize them, and actually perform them. So it takes a little bit of tenacity to really take the poems and memorize them in such a way where there's music and there's the sound of the timbre and the rhythm of it also all fused into one. And I like to think too that my voice is more, I don't know, it's very unique, I think. And my poetry and my voice does not fit into a particular box, because I can do this type of poem or that. I like to think that my voice is more like, how can I say, the gospel of soul, and jazz tapping at the hard rock of believing, you know? And so when I weave my words together, I'm looking at music, I'm looking at sound, how it sounds to me, how it sounds to the audience, how it rolls off my tongue. And so there's certain words that I'll choose, in alliteration or some internal rhyme, that I choose that are going to maybe touch the audience in a certain way. You never know who your words are going to touch in the audience, and you may have just various backgrounds of people. And so when I'm performing, it's like I would like to hit all these different personalities. You don't always do that, but when you're looking out from the stage to the audience, you just see their faces and you see them thinking and you see, you know, some other expressions too. But I don't know. I like the energy that's behind performing.
Yeah, and I think that like when I read a poem that really just sings all the way through, and you go to a performance or you're in a performance that sing like it just it hums like it has a similar quality where it just feels right, and it feels like you're on this emotional. I love performance, and it's such an important part of poetry because of sound. Do you remember the first time that you ever felt like you were on stage, you were performing something, and you felt that hum for the first time?
I did. The very first time I performed this poem, it was the and you might have heard it at some other venue. It was the poem about Ella Fitzgerald. And so that's a jazz poem, and it was the second poem I've ever written that was spoken word, ever. And so it's fairly old, but I wrote it, and we were going to perform it at some church had invited us, and it was some kind of event. And we're up on stage, and I remember telling my poet colleague, I said, "I'm just going to take my paper." He said, "Take the paper up there, it's fine." And somewhere within the first, I don't know, minute, maybe less than a minute, I put the paper down. I was just flowing with it. It was just flowing with these words. It's like I had all that in me, and I did not know it, until it all came out. And when you stop, as a performance artist, you have to stop reading the paper inside your mind, and just throw it away and just know it, for yourself. It's like rote memory, it comes. And so when I memorize anything, I normally memorize the gestures right into it, so it's all natural. I can't tell you what word this is or what word is or anything like that, but those things are memorized into the performance. So, but yeah, that was the first time I just started flowing with this thing. It's like, and when the end came, it's like, oh my gosh, did I just do that all without paper? It's like, yes, you did it. It's like, yeah.
Could you describe how it felt at the end a little more? Like, how did you feel like walking off the stage? Were you exhilarated? Were you?
I was exhilarated. I felt accomplished. I felt heard. I felt like I did this thing that I didn't think I really in the back of my mind knew I could do. But I walked up on the stage, so I knew I was going to do it. And even though your heart is like pounding, nobody hears that but you. And sometimes if you let it take you over, it'll kind of chop your words up, in a way. So you just do it, and you say a little prayer when you get up there. It's like, okay, take a deep breath, and just go. And then a couple of times, even after that, after I got used to that feeling, a few times I would recite the poem, and I knew it inside and out, but I flipped some words in there. I flipped words in there. It's like I had a brain freeze. Literally, but nobody knew it but me. And I flipped this word in, put this word in there, took a little something, I did, and I walked around and did, it made it just seem natural. And I got back on track and finished it. And it's like, oh, my goodness. That was a lot of work. That's a lot of effort. And so, I mean, it's just one of those things. Nobody sees you sweating. You might feel, perspiration running down your back or something like that, but nobody else sees that. And it's to you, it may not seem like a smooth performance, but when you're done with it and you've covered all your bases, it's great. It feels wonderful. It feels fulfilling, and it's I've never really felt like that just reading from a book, when you're live on a stage, you're looking at the audience, you're feeling that energy that they're giving you. And at sometimes you don't feel that energy. You're wondering in your head as you're reciting, what are they thinking? Am I doing it wrong? How can they know you're doing it wrong when they don't even know what you're going to say? They don't know anything. But once we did, this was several years ago, I was asked to do, this was part of a recovery service at church, and I was asked to do spoken word. And I said, "Is there a theme?" She said, "Oh, the seven deadly sins." So, okay, so that means there's seven people in my mind. There's gonna be seven people. You have envy, gluttony, pride, wrath, lust, sloth. Am I missing one? Jealous or envy. And so I wrote monologues, spoken word monologues for these pieces for each person. And I had two other colleagues to write two others. And we performed it and went up on stage and performed it. And it was something that the congregation had never seen before because it was different. It was spoken word, it was poetry, but in a way that ministered to the people. So, when we're done with that, it took all of like 10 minutes, because it was like not very long. But we walked off the stage and we walked to the back of the sanctuary, and you could just hear almost a pin drop and people just, really clapping and praising all this thing. And we just stood back, and that was a sermon. We were shocked. Like nothing else happened. They opened the doors of the church, and I mean, it was like a celebration. It's like, oh my gosh, to be that powerful and to have a voice that resonates with people, have a voice that really touches people's hearts and touches them in a way that transforms them. I like that aspect of it, of poetry. I like that aspect of playwriting. I like the aspect of it when I teach or present workshops for like the women of at Naomi, or the elders at the nursing homes. It was Sunset when I did it. Now they've changed to Otter Beam, but just to see people's faces after you've performed or after you've taught them something is rich and is valuable, and it makes me feel rewarded some kind. And it's really rewarding to me because people have changed from maybe this mindset to this mindset over here. I mean, if I could be a part of that and just maybe touch one person, I think I might have done my job. So.
Nice. Now, I wanted to we're going to talk about your chapbook like eminently, but you had mentioned something about, one of the things that I've noticed, like one of the things I've noticed about you and your work is that you have a disciplined sense of involvement in the sense that like you find it deeply rewarding to be around other people and to engage with them, and not even necessarily to ch teach, but to be a part of it and to throw energy in and to feel the energy coming back out. And so I wanted to ask you once mentioned that one aspect of working in theater at a high level, and I mean like high level in terms of like how far you are away from the performance, like playwright director level, that you what you enjoyed was that you saw it as an opportunity to positively impact others around you. So how does being involved relate to your work as a poet or a creative artist, since you have so many things going on? And do you have any specific stories or examples of a time where you felt the role of community or personal relationships played a significant re role in the outcome of a project or changed yourself? That's a really wordy, I will
Great
repeat
question.
it. Yeah, I know, I'm sorry.
Let me see here. From a poet to a playwright, can I like tackle that aspect right now, or
Please, any
okay?
if that
So
sparked anything in you, please talk about it.
I'm a poet, and I'm a creative person. And in that vein, I'm always going to pull in something creative no matter what I'm doing. If I'm writing prose or an essay, I'm going to pull some poetic device into it. Not that it's all poetry or anything like that, but it has like a flow to it, it has music in it. And so in the playwriting, I've written for like plays for my church. And that's how it all started. I saw an opportunity to. There was a opportunity or vacancy for someone to come in and to be over the drama ministry at our church. And so I thought, well, let's just write this, and basically it was either for the major holidays, write something. So either I write everything, write it, direct it, and produce the whole thing, but I had a team working with me. And I like that idea of everybody working together. I'm a leader, but I'm a working leader. I'm not going to tell somebody else something to do and I've not done it myself, you know? And if I don't know how to do it, I'm going to figure it out how to do it so I can tell you how to do it. And so in the playwriting aspect, I would go ahead and write the play, okay? And I would schedule the rehearsals. And then, or before the rehearsal, I would find the cast members. And so there were people who were really reluctant to be a part of a play, to be in the limelight, you know, and here, and my director, writers had, producers had, I'm in the background. And so I encourage them, you know, I give them experience like, hey, you know, I've done this. I know you could do it too. Case in point was, you know, after all this playwriting from, you know, at church and encouraging everybody to be a part of it, in the midst of all that was an opportunity that a friend gave me or told me about was to, for me to apply for this play, this community play. I thought, I don't know, you know, I work behind the scenes, you know, and she said, but you can do it. You can do it. So I did do it. I had memorized a monologue that I had from an acting class that I had taken, you know, here in Toledo. And I used that as my audition. And I got up there. I was really versed in this monologue. It was all like 2 minutes. Yeah. And I performed it. And I thought, okay, I did my best. They were smiling, but I wasn't sure if I was going to get that role. And in my mind, it's like, I didn't really want it. I didn't want it. I just wanted one line. And if I can be a background person, that'd be fine. But a week and a half later, I got an email. I got the role as a support person, as an attorney. I thought, oh my gosh, now I have to walk the talk. I have to do what I've encouraged other people to do, you know, and get that and you know, walk in that. So that's what I did. But aside from that, there was a young lady who was in the play. She had never acted before, but I innately will see people who can play these roles, and I hand selected these people. You know, I hand selected the actors or the, you know, the cast members. And this one young lady, it was, I think the name of the play was Signed, Sealed, and Delivered. So it was a musical, it was kind of hip hop, and it had adults and young people in there, and it had all this really nice music in the background, you know, all the way through, and the nice sound effects and all this. And I said, you can do this. And so, and she was not confident about it, but I kept pushing at her and pushing her and like, you could do this. I see you in this role. You know, you're an actor, but I don't act, but you don't, but you're acting here. We're going to do this. And so she didn't get it until after the play was over. And she came up to me and she said, you know what? I thank you for pushing me to do this. Because there was something within the character that she played was inside of herself. And that was something that she needed to act out, if you will, you know. So it was rewarding to hear that and know that, you know, what I encouraged somebody else to do, that it touched them in a way that made them feel worthy or that they have done something meaningful, you know, to serve other people. So, and that's what I like about, you know, the transformations and how people can change one mindset to the other. In my role as a diversity trainer and as an EEO officer, it's somewhat the same thing. You know, people in the same room or on the diversity training side, people in the same room, and I was a trainer, and I had to lead this organization. There were other trainers with me, but lead this discussion in terms of stereotypes or, you know, racism and things like that. And, you know, at the time, people were not really wanting to be engaged in that type of dialogue. But I found a way, like I do everything else, in presenting it in a way that leveled the playing field and that made people feel like their voice mattered, things like that. And so I see that also in the work that I do in poetry and serving in the community in different capacities.
What would you say is the most important factor for someone to feel seen? Like if
Okay.
someone like if for someone to feel seen, for someone to feel like, you're describing empowerment. You're describing people who want to feel like they matter, like their voice is heard. And you're talking about you have this example of someone who said, "Thank you for pushing me to do this." So, what do you think is that drive that pushes us past all that fear that, like, we don't want to share, we don't want to do this, but we do it anyway, and we're grateful for the people who get us to that next stage? And what do you have to say about, like, in terms of, like, once we're there, how do we reflect on it, and what do we hope others, how do they interpret it? You know what I mean?
Well, for me, I push myself. Early on in life, I was kind of introverted. I was not outgoing, but I always wanted to do it, Thus, I skied down a slope before. I've never gone skiing before, but I challenged myself. I said, I told my husband, we're going to go on a ski trip.
What kind of
And he was
slope?
shocked. He was shocked. I'm like, it was on my bucket list, you have things. Unless you do it, I probably won't do it again because of, some different health challenges and things like that, but it was fun. I don't know how many times I fell down that hill, that big hill, not the bunny hill, the bigger one, and just rolled and packed snow all in my suit, at the bottom of the hill. But I push myself despite challenges, and I'm not going to say that I don't have any challenges because I have some eye challenges and things like that, but it has not stopped me from doing what I need to do, or what I want to do, or what I desire to do, what I want to accomplish in my life, And so when I'm sharing with other people, I usually tell them my story. Hey, I did this, and this is how it happened. This is what came out of it. So if I can do it, I know you can too. And so that kind of opens the door a little bit for individuals, like such the women who are in Naomi, the woman that I served in Naomi at the treatment facility. These are women who were recovering from alcohol and substance abuse, and some broken lives there. And so the challenge was to come in. They had wanted to be part of their curriculum, a poetry workshop. And so I didn't know anything about writing, I mean, about not writing poetry, but I didn't know anything about putting together a poetry workshop. So I started putting these ideas together, and they just said something basic because they may not know. So I go in there with all this da-da sort of stuff, and part of me was a little, maybe slightly intimidated because I didn't know what to expect. I'm thinking these women are, really, they're going to look right straight through me, so I kind of had to be transparent, but I didn't know what to expect. So I go in there and start a conversation. We have an icebreaker and these, this nature, and to find out that a lot of the women did not know what poetry was. Some of them didn't know what poetry was. Some of them did not have a GED. And so I had to think, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to kind of scale back a little bit and just make it really simplistic. Let's just write a sentence. Let's just, I'll discuss what poetry is and things like that. And I saw the women start opening up. I started encouraging them about what they could do. Whatever they, wrote down, it was encouraged, it was validated, And I would do a little bit more, they'd give me a little bit more, and vice versa. And, so I, and that was a volunteer position in the community, and it was a beautiful experience. And so the women were able to, I got them out of their comfort zone, and we practiced and everything, and went down to the public library, and they did their reading there. And I found a restaurant that didn't serve alcohol. I think it was a vegetarian vegan restaurant at the time, and they had carved up a Monday night space once a month for us, for the ladies to come in there. They would serve their dinner, and they would do their poetry. So there was, a lot of little bit of networking and a little bit of them being encouraged to have their own voice. It's important for people to have their voices. It's important to be to know that your voice is not non-valid. Your voice is important, it's meaningful, it has worthiness, it has value to it. And we all have something to contribute. And so that's why I write the way I do, because to me, if I don't put my voice out there, that's one voice missing from what they could hear, And I just feel like, we all have something to contribute. And that's, even though it's unique, unique is good, because if we're all the same, somebody would not be needed, right? That's why there's, somebody's got to be a hamburger, somebody's got to be a steak sandwich, somebody got to be a fish or salad or vegan meal or vegetarian meal. All these diversities,
And as an introvert dealing with people who are, walled off emotionally for various reasons, was being, being an introvert, was it easy to kind of, were there aspects of your of being an introvert that you could apply to building those bridges, or were there things that surprised you when you tried to build those bridges that you're like, oh my God, I didn't did ever
Well,
do this?
like anything else, you kind of, I mean, even though people are different different worldviews and that, you find the commonality, and that's where you meet. And so in serving women with poetry, I find something that they have in common that I can kind of work with and deal with there, at that level. For people who have never been in theater before, I encourage them and kind of like take them by the hand and really encourage them to say, you could do this, and just really make them feel that they could do anything, basically. And these are adults and young people. And I even had a young girl sing who never sang before. She didn't want to sing, but I got her to do it.
Nice. That's
I got her to do it.
nice.
And I had one woman who was, she was older, not, a little older. And she said, "I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't be on stage. I'm in the background." I said, "I was in the background too, but I've been encouraged to be in the foreground, so that's what I'm doing. And I know you could do it." And just people, just I guess they trust me, because if I can share my story or my testimony, if you will, and they say they trust what I'm saying, and hopefully. I don't steer them wrong. I mean, because it happens the way I said it's going to happen, and they're surprised by the outpouring of support that they receive and the commentary they receive after the fact. And people are just, I don't know, blessed by it. I hope that answers your question. I know I'm rambling, so
That's okay.
sorry.
That's okay. I do. I'm going to turn to your newest book, which congratulations, as we cover ourselves with life, light. I'm sorry, light. So I wanted to ask you, what were your goals, your aspirations, and how did the project change as you began working on it?
Well, it's always been my initial goal to write a collection of poems. And so my goal was to pull together a cohesive manuscript about family and send it off. But before that, this book is a variation of other manuscripts I tried to send out, but they just weren't what anybody was looking for. Taking all the poems I've ever written and putting them in a book, and that did not have a theme. So my idea is to write from a place of experience. And in this book, there were snapshot memories that I could never get out of my head, memories as early as maybe 10. And I'm thinking, this happened, and I remember this and that. But and everything was steeped in a recipe of ingredients that I wanted people to consider, And so this final version, I'm employing what I call personal writing, Things from experience. And I set out to center on a theme of family and dealing with themes such as love and faith and loss and even racism, which is weaved in through some of these stories. I wanted to have this book be about dealing with difficult realities in life, and not only faith and acceptance, but the things that we cannot change. When we're growing up, there are things we can't change, but those things that we can't change and things we did shape who we really are. So it's me reconciling with that fact and just being at ease, being okay with it. I wanted to celebrate family and honor family. And even though things weren't exactly the way, a kid wants things a certain way, but as an adult, you're shining your light on this situation. It's like, oh, okay. Well, I know how to deal with it as an adult, but as a kid, it was a little difficult, maybe in some situations, but always, and also finding maybe humor, in some stories. And being transparent about putting this book together, I had to ask my mom, as there's some stories about her in there. She said, oh no, that's fine. And she reads it and she laughs and she remembers. And then sometimes, there might be a couple of tears shed because she remembers exactly. So all of these stories in this book are real. I just added a little bit of metaphoric oomph to it.
All of them.
Yes.
Oh, well, I encourage people to read this book then. Well, I mean, I encourage people to read the book anyway, but that really does take it up a level because it's got some really interesting anecdotes. So like you're sitting around and you set out to write about a family, and this family encounters very difficult situations. And I kept thinking the whole way through, what does the author think about the family unit? Like, how would you define it? Like, what are the different pieces there? Like, are the external and internal pressures, how do they like fight each other? Because I didn't realize that this was, it's not a memoir, but like, I didn't realize that these were all true. I just thought it was like, you had this focus on this group of people and you wanted to do something with them. So how did you like bake that? And like, how did you see what the family was and how the family would be represented for readers?
Well, to me, a family is a group of people that live together. You have the nuclear family, you have the single parent family. And in my case, we had the nuclear family and then not. It went from nuclear family to single parent family. Okay. But I wanted to capture what I was feeling at the time. And not that I was sad or anything like that, but just, I started asking questions to myself, well, why didn't this happen? Or we didn't do this, and I wonder why that, and a lot of whys. And I started writing things down as all my recollection about these experiences. And I came up with that. Then now some of these poems were published prior to, and I've added it to this collection. And it focuses on some main characters of this book. And I just wanted to kind of keep it about how either not how I was raised exactly, but some of the experience that came out of my life and the idea of having it resonate with other people also, and that's where that commonality comes from, being able to share the same experiences. But well, maybe you have an experience a little bit different than mine, or even within our families, we have varied experiences. And so I just wanted to do something that honored, my family and talked about those issues that were might have been a struggle for some of my family members, at the time. But at the time, I mean, that's just how it was. It's how it was, and it's how we deal with things. And I think somebody else had asked me about the title of the book. Now, the title, As We Cover Ourselves with Light, is taken out from a line in one of the poems toward the end of the book called The Quilt Maker, you know? And I think the line says, as we cover ourselves with her light. And so in the actual title, people can interpret it a couple of different ways. You got the divine light, okay? And you have the light of being optimistic and having that hope that no matter what goes on in the family, no matter what, what obstacles come your way, there's always this hope to get beyond that because you need to. You need to live, you know, and not be stuck in a certain genre of the past, you know what I'm saying? So yeah, that's my take on it. And then also bring in the music and the color of the language of the words and all these things to make it kind of elevate the actual story that's being told.
Which you're very good at. Do you have a favorite craft technique? Is there's like something that you, because like your symbolism and your metaphors are awesome, but I'm just curious if you have like a certain thing where you're like, no, I just really like suspense. I like line breaks.
I like movies. I love musicals. I love theater. I love all those things. And so I try and put in some of those elements of those things in there, but not really intentional. So when I read my work again, you know, when I read my work, I'm actually re-inspiring myself again. So when I had a writer's block or I can't get past something, I'll just take one of my poems that's been published and read it. And I get that boost of energy again. But I don't know. I mean, that's my take on it.
No, I would have never have guessed, at least the first try. Obviously the editing is intentional, right? Like you're not like surprised in the editing process, or maybe you
No, I
are
no,
you?
I've had to edit and rewrite and do all that stuff to it. It's like, oh. And then once I got it to where I wanted to go, I sent it to the publisher. And Haley Mitchell Hagen did a really good job in pinpointing just a few things. You know, she just had a few things. And I'm like, oh, wow, really? You only had a few things? And I looked at it and like, I worked hard on this. I mean, this was an effort. And I was just determined and just to get it done because I knew somebody had to read it. Somebody had to hear it, you know, hear the poems.
Yeah. Were you did you surprise yourself as you were writing? Like, did you write stuff and you're like, oh my God.
I did. It was a lot. And it wasn't until okay, so when I sent the manuscript around a couple of times it got rejected, but when it landed at Schlaganig, I was challenged to write more poems to bring up to 40, because I think I sent it like 21 poems for a contest or something. And she asked the question, can you do 17 more poems? Can you add 17 more poems to this? I said, yes, I can. And so those poems came from the ideas I had in my head and some other poems I need to polish up. And so that surprised me that I got it all together within a couple of months, brought it all the way up to 40. And I felt proud in that moment that I could do something like that. But then I was determined to get it done. I was determined, you know, really, because this book was a long time coming.
Yeah.
And I really needed to get these things out and just tell these stories. Another aspect is I think I mentioned before that I had to change a title or two, and then those poems got published individually before I put them in this book also. And there was one particular poem in there that I wrote, and I sent it off, and surprisingly got published. And I thought, after they get published, I go back and read those books, and like I read it with a little trepidation, like I don't want them to find a typo or anything like that in there. But no, I read this poem, and it wasn't until I read this poem in the book that I knew what it was really about. You know, that surprised me because I thought I knew what it was about at the beginning when I sent the poem, but after I read it, after it was published in the book, I was surprised.
Yeah.
I was talking about something that I hadn't really brought up before. So that surprised me. But yeah, just the fact that I kept going and didn't give up after rejections and other rejections, that I had the fortitude to stick with it, you know.
Yeah. And that's and it can be tough for writers. I think they submit stuff and they get their first round of rejections and they're like, oh, well, nobody likes it. And it's like, well, that's not, they're just inundated. They got so much to choose from. They have so much to read and they have to make snap decisions on the spot because they have so much to get through and they also have their personal lives. Like, it's just, you can't take it personally. And I'm glad that you persevered because the work is really good. From a high level, because you're writing about this family, and I can definitely attest, because I wrote a chapbook about a family, and its scope is difficult. It's really hard. I felt like I was creating this space that was both very big and very small at the same time. And what I mean by that is, like, I don't know if you felt this, and you can, I'd love to hear your experience, because I had a family and I wanted to explore different aspects of their lives, but every time I felt like I added something about their life, I felt like it needed to be explored more. But it's a chapbook, so you don't have a lot of space. So
No.
how did you feel that pressure, and how did you choose what threads to follow? Because I would love to hear someone else talk about this.
Well, knowing it was going to be a chat book, you know, in my mind, I had read a chat book by Cornelius Eddy. He's one of the co-founders of Kavakana. And his one book, You Don't Miss Water, you don't miss my water, the water. That was one of the books I've read over and over and over again. And I think it was a small chap book too. Maybe it might have had 50 poems. I'm not sure. Maybe just out of that range. But it was something that resonated with me that I said, when I do my own chap book, when I do my own collection, I was going to do these prose poems. There's only a few in this book. The rest of them are free verse, or maybe there's a couple of forms in here, but that's what I wanted, because it to he told these stories in these snapshotted ways, and that's what I wanted to do in this book. But surprisingly, it didn't happen that way. So what I wanted to do is try and keep a poem on a page, so people to keep people turning. You know, I was thinking that, but when I started in with one poem, I wanted it to be concise. And so that's where all the editing comes in. Tell it like a story, you know, not tell, not show, but not tell. You know, tell the story, but show it. You know, show it in language, show it in emotion, show it in the color of these characters in a way that will pull in people who read it or who hear it. So I had heard about the economy of words. I thought, how does that work with my poems? I'm going to tell the story, and whenever the poem is done, that's when it's done. And I just let it go at that. And I would go back in after I read it, let it sit for a while, go back in and take out the non-essential words. Words that I felt were duplicated in another line. I'm not talking about a pontoon, no, because those have to be reduplicated in the next stanza, but take out the non-essential words that are not needed to be in there. And so that's what I started doing, you know, all this editing. But to tell the story is basically just tell. I'm telling what my experience was in this story, in this poem, and from top to finish. Now, do I go back and add a couple of things in there? Yes, I've done that because it felt like it needed something. And there's a couple of times I've gone back into a poem and taken something out because it seemed like it wasn't cohesive in there. It did not flow with the rest of the storyline. So
Yeah, and was there a point when you're working on it where you felt, every project I've worked, I'm sorry, I'm relating like personal experiences to the, trying to gauge how what your experience was. But like when you're working on the project, did you feel like there was a point where a switch was flipped and all of a sudden you went from feeding the machine to suddenly it's its own animal, and now you have to do what it wants, not vice versa.
Exactly. One such poem was the Colored Imagination. I didn't start it to be a pontoon at all. I wanted to just tell the story. And it was, at first, it was just going to be a prose poem. But then I kept adding a line here. And then in my head, it's like, what about a pontoon? It's like a pontoon, that makes it longer. But I kept repeating the story because that particular form of poem actually worked in this, because I'm repeating the story as if racism is still repeating. I'm telling the story in a repetitive manner because of the device of the poem. And so the length of the poem is exactly the length it's supposed to be. And sometimes I'll play with some forms. There's a lot of couplets in there, but mostly free verse. But that poem sort of took over itself, and there's a couple of them that took over, and it surprised me that that's the way it was. Patriarch was another one, and there's several others in there. I set out to talk about one thing, and it ends up to be something else. I think which one. A Distant Hymn. That's one that does that for me.
So how did it start and how did it end?
Well, it starts up talking about a car in a driveway, and how it always sits there on Sundays. And while three of us go to church, and I'm not quoting it from the poem. We start out with opening the door of a different hymn. Now, hymn is another one of those homonyms, whether it's HIM or HYMN, right? And so you leave it up to the reader's interpretation. What are you talking about? Which hymn are you talking about? And so we start out, the four of us, opening these doors with different expectations of life. But at the end, we're no longer in that door. We're opening up the door, but we're walking, the three of us, under an umbrella in the weather. And the weather is a metaphor for how life, what life throws at you.
And like when you how do you decide you're done? So you leave things open-ended, and that's, oh, I have so many questions for you. I just want to talk. So how open-ended do you like to leave poems, and how comfortable does it make you feel that those interpretations can be as varied as they are? And if a reader has an interpretation of something that you didn't expect because you didn't intend to leave that open-ended, does that make you uncomfortable?
No, not at all. Because people are going to interpret whatever they interpret. Kind of like a Bible, you get a scripture, everybody's going to interpret it differently, right? Depending on where they are in life. So in this poem, if it seems open-ended, I want maybe the not that I want them to, but the reader can interpret that ending. They can put themselves in that place and maybe finish it. Maybe if they have any problems or concerns about the ending not being closed or having a closure to it, then perhaps there's something within themselves or within their own experiences that is unresolved, I think. But I welcome anyone to have comments about the ending. It's fine. The poem was done. That's how I ended it. The poem was over with. because I'm done with that memory now. That's all I know about it, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's about this car, started out with this car in the driveway, sits there, you know, it never runs, especially on Sundays, you
Yeah.
know? And so, and that's how it ended.
Yeah. All right. Final question. What do you want the state of Ohio to know about Sandra?
Oh my gosh. Okay. The state of Ohio. Let me think about that. Well,
second in flight. This time to space. No, I'm kidding. We've had multiple astronauts. That's not even true.
I am available for readings.
Well, you heard it, folks.
I'm available
From
for
Cincinnati to Toledo.
And discussion of my book, As We Cover Ourselves with Light. I enjoy putting this book together, and I would welcome the opportunity to discuss it.
Excellent. Please schedule Sandra for readings. Please pick up the book, get it, read it. It's good. Sandra, could you please read one more poem before we head out?
Yes, I will. And I'm going to do something that's not in this book, only because this poem was published in September this year in Flights Literary Magazine, which is out of Dayton, Ohio, from Sinclair College. So this is called TikToks. It's one of my social injustice poems. So TikTok, for Trayvon Martin and others. Clocks are a community of watchers. I have seen their hands evict souls from the freedom of homes and declare the bodies buried. He is a tree in the black forest, standing in front of a house on fire, his hands dialing back a memory. To say 400 years is not premeditated, is to say that perpetual mourning is life on even playing fields. I stand under the flicker of street light, casting eerie shadows on my lawn, but home as safe as Brianna, as careful as Elijah's rhythm, becoming a stopwatch. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sandra. That was wonderful. All right. This has been Poetry Spotlight, a production of the Ohio Poetry Association. Please follow the OPA on Twitter at Ohio Poetry and on Facebook at facebook.com/Ohio Poetry. A transcript of this episode can be found on the OPA blog. Visit ohiopoetryassociation.org for more information. Sandra, thank you again for doing this. It was wonderful.
Thank you, Jeremy, for having me. I really appreciate it. This has been fun.